Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Oh, yeah! Welcome to another edition of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I'm Pat Johnston, and I'm releasing this week's episode a day earlier so that many of you would have some exciting yet informative content to listen to while you're making your Thanksgiving travels. Now, after Thanksgiving Thursday, and this is a rule I've always adhered to, Christmas season can now officially begin. That means it's okay to get some decorations up and around the house. You see, I prefer doing decorations in stages. So, for instance, I'll put a couple of decorations above the fireplace, and then I'll put some LED Christmas candles in every window of the house. The Christmas tree, however, does not, and I repeat, does not see daylight until the first weekend of December. And yes, it's a fake tree, which isn't all that bad since I don't have to vacuum up needles or worry about the house burning down. Now, for those of you that purchase a real tree, or better yet, cut down your own tree, more power to you. Congratulations. I do not criticize. I just don't want to do all of that work. Oh, and Christmas music is allowed to slowly, and I mean slowly, creep into my song lists on Black Friday as well. Also, don't forget about shopping at some of those local stores in your towns and cities. They are the lifelines of our neighborhoods, and they are what give our towns a unique feel, so please don't forget about them. And while I'm at it, don't forget to subscribe and download each and every episode of the Left of Lansing podcast. You'll especially want to download this week's show as a good friend of the podcast, author Anna Clark of the book called The Poison City, Flint's Water and the American Urban Tragedy, is coming back on later to discuss an article that she wrote in ProPublica about Michigan's emergency manager law, the same law which led to the man-made disaster in Flint last decade. Anna's article describes how Michigan Republicans overrode the will of the voters back in 2012 when they reinstated the emergency manager law, which we chose to eliminate in a ballot initiative. And not only did they thwart the will of the voters, and not only did they reinstate the law, but they ensured we'd never be allowed to put the issue back on the ballot again. So just remember, whenever you hear Michigan Republicans complain about freedom, remind them how they canceled our votes back in 2012 when we tried to get rid of the emergency manager law, which is still on the books and which allows the state to remove democracy from local governments. And as we saw in Flint, that law will forever haunt that city for decades to come. Anna Clark will join me in just a moment to talk more about the emergency manager law, how it's been predominantly used in majority-minority cities, and why Democrats must make it imperative to gut that law completely in the next legislative session once they get full power again in the State House next year. Now, speaking of this year, which is all finished in the state legislature, Democrats, as I have noted here throughout the year, have won some important victories, and some of those victories are ones that we've been waiting for a long time to experience. And some of those victories surround the new gun safety laws, which got an extra push after the tragedy on the Michigan State University campus last winter. And also, let's not forget, give credit to young voters for not only helping get those bills through the legislature and to Governor Whitmer's desk for her signature, but let's give credit to those young voters for helping vote some progressive Democrats into the legislature and for helping switch that legislature from red to blue. Now, Democrats earlier this year passed expanded universal background checks, safe storage laws, and red flag laws when it came to gun safety measures. However, Democrats also helped push through one more gun safety victory just before the session ended, and this one is a biggie. And that's from the signing ceremony this week in which Governor Whitmer signed a bill package into law banning domestic abusers from owning a firearm. She signed three bills creating an 8-year ban for those convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence-related offenses from possessing, carrying, or distributing firearms. The legislation also expands offenses related to domestic violence that advocates said during the legislative process would more clearly encapsulate what domestic violence can entail, according to Michigan Advance. And congratulations to friend of the podcast, Democratic State Senator Stephanie Chang from Detroit, on sponsoring these bills and helping get them passed. Once again, a strong progressive like Senator Chang demonstrates how progressive values and solutions are common sense values and solutions. As Senator Chang pointed out during the signing ceremony, about half of the women murdered in the United States are murdered by a current or former intimate partner. Even more, women are 5 times as likely to be killed by that partner if the person owns a firearm. And MLive reported more on how this bill will further protect women. A person won't get to own a gun if they received a misdemeanor involving domestic violence, which includes a host of charges, including assault and battery, vulnerable adult abuse, stalking, fourth-degree criminal sexual conduct, and intentional destruction of another person's personal property. Now, who fits under the legal interpretation of these bills? Again, MLive says the survivor would have to fit a certain profile, including one of the following. They are the convicted person's spouse or former spouse. They have or had a dating relationship with the convicted person. They have or had a child in common with the convicted person. They are a resident or former resident of the convicted person's household. And they are the victim's parent or guardian. You see, these laws will help save the lives of so many women. Will it save every woman who's experienced domestic violence? No. But will it save many lives? Yes. And guess what? Once again, Michigan Republicans showed their complete disdain for women, as most of them voted against the bills because Republicans show more love for guns than they do of human beings. They'd rather have men who've beaten, harassed, and terrorized women owning guns. That's why they voted for the bills. They'd rather have these guys owning guns. And because the bills didn't receive 2/3 support, the laws won't go into effect for a few months. So congratulations, Michigan Republicans. Job well done for domestic abusers. You know, I can't wait to see your campaign ads next year. We fought to keep guns in the hands of domestic abusers. It's a bold strategy, and I can't wait to see how it turns out. Again, progressive values are common sense values. I mean, what in the name of Christian nationalist Republicans can be called common sense? Seriously, they want dangerous criminals and domestic abusers owning guns at all times. They want less spending on mental health to help prevent school shootings. They want more fossil fuels in our already damaged and polluted air and water. They watched as people fled the state due to a crumbling infrastructure while they ripped away rights from workers and handed lavish tax cuts to their donor base. And they fought against allowing women to have a say over their bodies and also did everything in their power to rip away and tear apart the will of the people by trying to steal the 2020 election for their fascist overlord, Donald Trump. There's nothing common sense about the Michigan Republican Party. They care more about banning history books and checking children's genitals than they care about actually moving the state into the future. They're about trying to push us back into the 1950s rather than into the 2050s. They have no ideas. They have no concrete policy ideas. They only care about Donald Trump. That is their identity. And that's why I like to end this week's monologue with this soundbite from Fox News Detroit's Let It Rip political talk show last week, in which longtime newsman Charlie Langton called out Republican State Representative Josh Schriever and the entire Michigan Republican Party for complaining endlessly about Democrats ramming bills through the state legislature.
Elections have consequences. You're Republican, right?
Yes.
And the makeup of the House is what?
Democrat.
And the Senate is what?
Democrat.
And the governor is what?
Democrat.
You lose. You're done. Done. Get more Republicans elected. Republicans, when they were in the majority, they did the same thing. The elections have consequences. Now, you should probably be up on the bills, but to ramming these things through, you knew the Democratic agenda. You knew what this guy was going to do.
Hear, hear. Crying and complaining because Michiganders voted to put Democrats in power is all the Republicans do anymore. And Charlie's right. They passed the failed right to work for less during a lame duck session, allowed the dangerous Line 5 pipeline to continue to operate during a lame duck session, and they passed the emergency manager law during lame duck. Republicans hate democracy, which is why they're trying to destroy it. And that's how the 2024 election must be covered by the press. All right? One side is fighting for democracy and for our democratic institutions, while the other side is fighting for fascism. They don't believe in the will of the people because they believe they're on the right side at all times. These are scary times indeed. Coming up, author and reporter for ProPublica, Anna Clark, on how we must gut the democracy-destroying emergency manager law before it's used again here in the future. And let me say a quick thanks to my good friend Rich for all of his hard work on leftoflansing.com and for also helping feed my cat this weekend. You're listening to LOL.
Left of Lansing podcast. If you truly want to get Pat fired up, talk about Tigers baseball or how you think the 90s produced the worst music of any decade. You've been warned. Email him at leftoflansing@gmail.com and follow him on Twitter at leftoflansing. Here's Pat.
Can't believe it. It's hard to believe that we've only got 3 episodes left after this one for the year. And I just have to tell you, I've had a great time reviving Left of Lansing after taking that 3-year hiatus. And I'm looking forward to a great 2024 with you. However, as we know, fighting for democracy is a progressive ideal. And it's one that we'll be talking about incessantly as we near another election year that'll have far-reaching consequences for years to come. And I'm not just talking about the presidential and congressional elections. Of course, they are important, but also the fight for Michigan State House and numerous local and school board elections as well. My job will be to help promote those who will fight for the progressive ideal of democracy all next year. And I appreciate your support. So please share episodes with friends and family. And also don't forget to subscribe and give a nice 5-star review of Left of Lansing, or I'll take a 4-star review. That's fine too, wherever you get your podcast. All right. Now, speaking of democracy, we kind of got a real life lesson on how that ideal can be put on hold here in Michigan over the last decade when Detroit and Flint lost their democracies to emergency managers. And as we saw in Flint, when unelected government officials are beholden to nobody and cities have no chance to fight back since democracy has been ripped away from them, it will have severe consequences that many will have to live with for the rest of their lives. Anna Clark wrote about how emergency managers grossly mismanaged what would become forever known as the Flint water crisis in her book, The Poisoned City, Flint's Water, and the American Urban Tragedy. She was on here a few years ago to talk about her book, which gives a full account into the many factors of what led to the crisis through years of government divestment and then leading to that emergency manager law. Anna's work hasn't stopped there, though. She's a reporter for ProPublica, and that's where she's written some stories on the history and failures of the emergency managers and how they take power away from communities which tend to be minority-majority cities, and why Michigan Democrats must prioritize ending the emergency manager law sometime here, hopefully by next year. So, Anna, thank you so much for coming back here on Left of Lansing. I greatly appreciate it.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, in your ProPublica article titled "Michigan Still Allows Emergency Takeovers of Local Governments, Is It Finally Time to Reconsider This Drastic Measure?" you give a full account about how these emergency managers gained power over some cities in Michigan due to the state's powerful emergency manager laws. Anna, can you start by explaining how this practice really got started here in Michigan, and if other states have similar laws in taking over their cities?
Sure. I mean, it is a pretty wonky, but also I think fascinating history. Well, for a long time, as background, you know, Michigan was one of a number of states that had some mechanism to intervene for in highly distressed school districts and cities. But there was a number of limits on that tool, and it was not used super frequently. There was a notable shift that happened in a little more than a decade ago when there was an effort by the state to really expand what those powers look like. So these emergency financial managers initially, which had a lot of power over like budgetary and financial issues, under the new initiative was going to, you know, really expand those powers to include basically everything, you know, like all power, you know, that otherwise would be held by an elected school board and superintendent or elected city council and mayor. Now, this law passed under the previous administration, and it was then overturned some months later by voters. Nearly everybody in Michigan, well, maybe not nearly everybody, but the majority of people in Michigan voted against this, but they thought that this was like kind of taking it a little too far. And about 6 weeks later, the lame duck legislature passed a law that virtually reinstated the previous version of the law. It did have some tweaks. It did have a few modifications, but it was basically the same thing. A really expanded system for a state-appointed administrator to come in and hold full authority within a public school or a public community, a municipality. And the difference this time was that it had some appropriation, some money attached to it. So now it couldn't be overturned by voters in a referendum. And from there, the state went on to use it much more frequently than you would see in other states. And the powers that the emergency managers then had was also far more expansive than what you would see in other states.
Okay, so I do remember this. I mean, in 2012, like you said, voters did back that initiative to eliminate the emergency manager law, but Republicans did find a way around it, not only to strengthen the law a bit, but the biggest part was, as you just mentioned, they found a way to ensure that we wouldn't have a say ever again in trying to change the emergency manager law or to eliminate it altogether. And that was done during lame duck. Is that right? Is that what she said?
Yeah, it was like, so like a voter referendum, the voter referendum passed or to overturn what was the then standing expansive emergency manager law. So that was in November. And by December, you know, like just about a month later, the new legislation to kind of basically reinstate it went through. And some have speculated, you know, some people I've talked to have speculated that like the urgency around that was like the state was preparing to put Detroit into bankruptcy. And they felt like an emergency manager was kind of needed for that. And so that was part of the heat, the fuel that was making this like move a little faster than one might otherwise expect.
Hmm. And under the state's emergency manager law, these people, once they are appointed, they're not obligated to adhere to any certain state laws, like let's say the Open Meetings Act, or they can keep their decision making in the dark, right? I mean, they're just not beholden to the people that they are overseeing, you could say.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's like no way of getting around it. It is just a, like suspending the systems and protocols of local democracy. It just is. And the defenders of it would argue that, you know, a lot of the times when it gets to the point where an emergency manager would come in, like things really are in an emergency. And that I don't disagree with. I mean, I live in Detroit. I mean, I remember what things were like. It was spiraling. It really did need some like outside support, but like the mechanism is a really tough and extreme one, you know, and it was used in a lot of different kind of communities. So not just Detroit and Flint, but also Benton Harbor and Allen Park and Ecorse and like Pontiac, you know, just a number of communities in one way or another were like affected by this. And their storylines had some similarities and some differences. But the fact is, you know, when this emergency manager comes in, they have full power to sell or buy city assets, to cut budgets. They can make or break union contracts. They really have like kind of total authority. And that somewhat modified version of the system that came in the law that passed in the lame duck session, it had initially a few more limits to it, like a time limit of 18 months. And after then, local officials would have to like kind of vote to keep you. But what happened in practice is that there was a workaround there too. I mean, like in Flint, which had a series of emergency managers over several years. I mean, that happened because somebody could resign and a new one would be reinstated and then the clock would just start over, you know? So even what modest limits there were on the system were pretty easily, like didn't actually do a ton to check its pretty enormous power.
Gotcha. And You mentioned that there were similarities with these cities that went under emergency management, like Detroit. You said Benton Harbor, obviously Flint. What were some of the similarities that you found?
Well, I mean, I guess the most obvious one is, like, you know, the majority of communities that were put under emergency management are communities that had high levels of poverty and were often like majority minority communities. In other words, they had a disproportionate number of people of color and had been struggling for decades with the consequences of systemic racism and chronic disinvestment. There often were very serious issues that did need some support, no matter how talented local officials might be. There's only so much you can do with a lot of the profound and harmful challenges that a lot of people were facing. But one thing that I tried to do in the article that appeared a little while ago at ProPublica was kind of address how the emergency management, according to the expert I was kind of featuring, would say that there's like a mismatch between the diagnosis and the prescription. And you can kind of see it on its own terms. I mean, when you look at a lot of those same communities that had an emergency manager, most of them are still struggling with a lot of those same issues. And, you know, a lot of times when the emergency manager exited, if they were able to kind of like have a somewhat balanced budget, it was often with a last minute infusion of cash or some other kind of outside intervention. The fact is, you know, a lot of the problems these communities are struggling with, the causes are not limited within its borders. You know, the causes go beyond its borders to a lot of policies and practices that made these communities precarious in the first place, you know? And even when a state chosen administrator has near total authority to do whatever they want, the problems persist. And I think that's a pretty clear sign that maybe we need to be looking at completely different kinds of solutions here.
Right, because we just keep getting to the same place again.
Yeah. And like a lot of these communities would just kind of get an emergency manager kind of reappointed. You know what I mean? And then the exceptions are communities where there was some other, like where the challenge that they were facing was more discreet. So like Allen Park was struggling with the reverberations of a failed movie studio deal from back in our Michigan's incentive era, you know, and E-Course, like they were struggling with, there was just a local corruption issue that like really did benefit to have like an outsider, you know, kind of right a ship and then get out of there. Detroit, people have complicated feelings about the bankruptcy, but it had a whole bankruptcy process. That makes it different, you know, than what played out in other communities. Most places, a lot of the problems they were facing then are very similar, if not exactly similar, to the problems they're facing still today.
And Anna, some of the researchers that you talked to in your article noticed that emergency managers, which you've already brought up here, I was just wondering if you could maybe just expound on it a bit, that these EMs tended to be used in Black majority cities. And that I think one researcher told you that it helps feed into this narrative of blaming Black governance for a city's financial problems. Could you go into that a little more?
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting insight in thinking about it, not just in terms of what residents of Michigan have access to local democracy and which don't, but also thinking about it through the lens of the leadership of those communities. So yeah, by 2017, 56% of Michigan's Black residents had lived in cities governed by emergency managers or other state oversight measures, according to a lawsuit that was filed to challenge this. And comparatively, just under 3% of white people had the same experience, according to that complaint, which is striking for a lot of reasons, not least because there are a lot of like poor, struggling white communities, you know, like in the Upper Peninsula and like former mining towns, like, you know, there are a lot of those. But like the intervention measure of this extreme intervention measure of emergency management was far more likely to be used in struggling communities with a predominantly Black population. And the researcher that you just mentioned, her name's Louise Seamster. She's a sociologist, and she feels that embedded in this practice is a mistrust, not only for voters of color, but specifically for the elected leadership of these communities who are people of color themselves. And this practice, this sustained practice of this, having these highly publicized emergency managers usurp authority in these communities, creates over time, she says, like a narrative, a structure to undercut their abilities and authority in ways that can have consequences well beyond the borders of that particular community.
That's right. I seem to recall some touting, those who supported emergency managers, they touted Detroit as an emergency manager success story. And they argued that the EM there, Kevin Orr, did exactly what he had to do to get Detroit back on track. And while it's arguable that maybe Orr did some good things, your research has revealed that it's not a completely rosy picture and that some walked away winning some big money at the expense of citizens who experienced some painful cuts. And like you said, you live in Detroit. So I was wondering if you could just talk more about that.
Yeah, this is really what I tried to grapple with a little bit. The whole impetus for this article in the first place was 10-year anniversary of Detroit's bankruptcy and kind of like reflecting on that. And the emergency manager was inextricably linked, you know, intertwined with the bankruptcy story. So the emergency manager was appointed. And in March 2013 and July 2013, we filed for bankruptcy. And he was a bankruptcy lawyer. That's the other notable thing. Like, unlike a lot of the emergency managers in Michigan, I think he's from Michigan. He has some connections to Michigan, but he was in from Washington, D.C., major law firm, kind of an outside expert, you know, who was brought in for a task, I would say. And then our bankruptcy process goes on for about, I don't know, 22 months or so. And I was trying to grapple with this, like how do you, you know, and talking to some folks about what is like, just trying to have a full understanding of what and why things happened, what the consequences were today. And on the plus side of the ledger, you know, we have $7 billion less in debt than we had when the bankruptcy was initiated, and billions more was restructured. That money was not just allowed, but required basically to like be reinvested in public services, which were sorely needed. Mm-hmm. And I think you can see in the city now, which is restored to elected leadership, you know, there has been a lot more movement in making the city safe, livable, thriving place, even in some places for a lot of people. So that's the good news. And how like that process might have gone without like somebody kind of spearheading the bankruptcy process, it is hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine how what that might have looked like under solely the mayor and city council, right? Or if it would have happened in the first place, because obviously bankruptcy is a pretty politically polarizing concept. So that's the good news. But the challenge is, of course, is that there is just enormous other consequences to this. And a lot of those major decisions, those high stakes decisions, were able to be made, as you mentioned before, without open meetings, without being subject to the Freedom of Information Act, without having to release records. So the public not only isn't an agent in the decision-making for their community, but the process can be kept secret from them even now, even after the fact. And that loss of transparency, that loss of collective decision-making is quite steep. And it's worth noting that the bankruptcy really kind of came to a conclusion with this grand bargain where, yeah, like you remember, like, so again, like having like an infusion, basically money really helps when you're broke, right? And this seems to be like what the resistance is on so many fronts. It's not just about, oh, somebody to come in and make the tough decisions. A lot of these broke communities had made tough decisions, you know, and were suffering the consequences for like extreme austerity, even before these folks come in, and they don't have much to work with when they get there. And a lot of times it does require some outside money to help find a somewhat more workable solution. So the grand bargain, that was like $800+ million of philanthropic dollars, public donations, all this stuff that helped reach a settlement that made the cuts less bad than they could have been. Though, as many people will note very quickly, those cuts are cuts. And especially for the pensioners, the retirees, that's brutally felt. They got cuts while a lot of like the city's creditors ends up getting free riverfront land. I mean, it feels deeply uncomfortable.
You just have a few minutes left here, and I want to talk about the history of Flint being under emergency managers under Governor Rick Snyder. And again, you wrote in great detail about these EMs in your book about the Flint water crisis, but something you wrote in your article really caught my eye too. And you quoted, I think his name is Eric Scorsone. Is that correct?
Scorsone, yeah.
Scorsone, mm-hmm. Who's an associate professor and director of Michigan State University's Extension Center for Local Government and Finance and Policy. And he told you, so I'm going to quote here if you don't mind. He said, I do think the Flint crisis did happen partly because Detroit was taking all the attention. As signs of trouble in Flint escalated, from residents protesting about health issues to a General Motors plant leaving the city water because it corroded its machinery, he described the reaction of some state officials, including the Treasury Department, as, yeah, whatever, it's just Flint. I was wondering, Anna, through your entire research into the Flint water crisis, did you also get the same sensation that the crisis happened partly because Detroit was taking up all the attention? And is that why, in part, the voices of Flint residents were being ignored for such a long time?
I think it's absolutely a contributing factor. I'd thought of this from the perspective of journalists, you know, being a journalist myself, you know, that about how our news infrastructure is already beleaguered and too small and too well ill-supported in the first place. But we do have talented reporters in the States. However, their talents were focused on Detroit's bankruptcy, and they did a lot of terrific work. You know, had that not been happening at the same time, might there have been better and stronger earlier reporting about what was going on in Flint? Perhaps. I've thought of that. When I talked to a former mayor of Flint who was elected on the very day he was elected, he learned Flint was getting its emergency manager. And this was before Detroit. This was a little while before Detroit. And he told me that he felt that Flint was used as kind of a test case, you know, for this kind of like new system for state intervention. So that's kind of stayed in my mind. And then here's Eric Scorsone, who used to work in the Treasury, you know, the Treasury being the agency that kind of supervises these emergency managers. And he's kind of noting the same thing, you know, from the perspective of public government, you know, like that the whole machinery of the state was like trying to had its attention focused on its largest city. There's important reasons, you know, that Detroit needed that, you know, like a lot of major attention, but it did make another emergency rising at the same time inevitably lower on the priority list. And I find this very alarming because I think, like, if we're going to build a healthy democracy, which I know you and your listeners care about, we need to figure out how to, you know, navigate more than one emergency at the same time, you know, because they don't happen conveniently one after the other.
Anna, I recently talked about how not one person who made some of those disastrous decisions leading to the water crisis in which residents were drinking lead-tainted water once the water was switched from Lake Huron to the Flint River lines in a cost-saving scheme. Not one person is going to face any kind of criminal prosecution. As you know, Attorney General Dana Nessel's office recently ended up announcing that they were dropping all the charges after the state Supreme Court ruled against the grand jury procedures that she and her office were using to bring those prosecutions forward. And so after that announcement, I read in Bridge Magazine, Alan Overton, a pastor of Flint's Christ Fellowship Missionary Baptist Church, and he said, "Injustice in this community has been the norm. This just continues to show us that this legal system that we call justice is not really justice at all." Since you have covered so much about this, I was just wondering if I could get your reaction when that news broke.
By the time that news broke, it wasn't a surprise, but I did feel the emotional punch of it. I mean, I think it's just so demoralizing that there's this, at this point, really well-known man-made disaster with serious consequences for both individuals and the community as a whole. And after multi-million dollar, multi-year criminal investigations, first under the previous Republican administration and now under the current Democratic administration, two different ones, two different tactics, both of them eventually leading to nothing. Like, we never even got to a trial. I mean, it's very painful. And I think, like, I know a lot of folks in Flint, like, really feel that they're once again, like, the systems are not coming through for them. And I think this deserves a lot more reflection on, like, if this couldn't be prosecuted, why not? If what laws, what mechanisms might need some rethinking? What other approaches to accountability could and should happen? The lack of any accountability at all is truly haunting.
All right. So we've got these emergency laws that are still in place. And in your article, you highlighted how Gretchen Whitmer signaled how she wanted to revisit or change that law when she was running for governor. But since Democrats took over the legislature last year, I really haven't seen any real movement that I know of. So talk more about that and what you've been hearing from some legislative Democrats on this front.
Yeah, this was interesting too, because, like, certainly Governor Whitmer campaigning in 2018 was very publicly opposed to the emergency manager law. So are a lot of the legislators who now have the majority in our state government right now. And yet the emergency manager law still sits on the books exactly the same as it ever was, you know, no changes at all. It's true that we don't have any actively serving emergency managers. And I remember the, you know, when the last community, I think it was Muskegon Heights' school district maybe, or when state oversight finally officially ended for them, I think the state sent a press release kind of like really promoting that, like, no, you know, like no state oversight for any Michigan communities for the first time in X number of years. So they kind of celebrated that, but they haven't changed that law, you know, and I think that's really interesting about why not. Perhaps it's just not on their priority list since nobody's actively serving right now. Perhaps, and there's like all these other things they want to do. Perhaps there are other uses or concerns that they have. Some folks I talked to were trying to like work, come up with like a workable alternative solution for what the state's role would be when you have like a community that really is in fiscal distress. It sounds like there are some folks who are concerned about it, including a legislator from Pontiac, a community that experienced emergency management. And I know they've, I believe there've been like some conversations and work on it, but as far as I know, none of this has really gained momentum and it's still TBD on whether this law will remain on the books for the next year.
and you know, with two Democrats leaving the state house here after they won elections for mayor, it's going to be an even split in the state house for months until special elections are held. I hate to be cynical, Anna, but I guess it just appears for the time being, at least for at least the next year, I'd have to think that this law will probably stay for the near future.
Unless people make it a priority.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
For their lawmaker, yes. You know, like it's, I mean, I think it's important to take stock. Like it seems like it's not a priority now, but as some people have like kind of pointed out, there likely will be another community that's in like serious distress at some point. What's to stop current or future lawmakers from using the same tactics as before? And now really is the time to like revisit what we're going to do, what we as a state could and should do, and what the appropriate checks and balances are for that.
All right. Listen, Anna, we've only got about a minute or two left, but you recently wrote about the report just released about the Oxford school shooting from 2021, in which four students were killed. The shooter pleaded guilty, and now prosecutors are also charging the shooter's parents with involuntary manslaughter for buying the shooter a gun. Can you give just a brief overview of what that article in ProPublica is about, and what were some of the important findings that you found from that report that maybe you didn't know beforehand? And maybe you could tell us how this might tie in with what you've been learning with emergency managers as well.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I did write about this report, and earlier this year, I spent spent some time with the community and did a different kind of story about how they were starved for some increased accountability and transparency from their local school districts. So I imagine, as most of your listeners know, the Oxford school shooting from nearly 2 years ago was unique in a number of ways, including the fact that the shooter had a number of interactions with the school district up to the very morning of the shooting. And so a lot of the families and community members who are sending their kids to the exact same school district led by the exact same people just 8 weeks later had a lot of questions, right, about what exactly happened and things that wouldn't necessarily just come out in necessarily in the criminal trials. Things about like how their school approaches threat assessment, how it approaches suicide intervention, just wanting to have more information on that. They had a long, frustrating saga in getting to this nearly 600-page report that came out just a couple of weeks ago by an independent investigator. Hugely comprehensive, very rarely done in the wake of school shootings. So this really is a standout thing. And it affirmed that there were a number of failures by the school district inappropriately, you know, carrying out threat assessment practices and policies. So folks can like look in that to find out more details of what that actually means. But I think it is an important thing to for folks in all kinds of communities to kind of be aware of. And it, like you kind of alluded to, it really reminds me a lot of what happened in Flint and a lot of other communities who just care about their communities, who care about their places, who experience some kind of crisis and just want more transparency and accountability when things go wrong, not in a punishing way, but in a way to help ensure future public safety and the well-being of their community. They just want to like make sure that we learn the lessons we need to, so we don't keep having these extremely painful life and death crises.
Absolutely. Anna Clark, author of The Poison City, Flint's Water, and the American Urban Tragedy, and reporter for ProPublica. Can people still get your book online anywhere, Anna?
They can. I love it when people get it from independent bookstores. If you want to buy it online, Bookshop is the place to go where you can buy it online, get it easily, and support independent bookstores on the way.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for being on this week, and I hope you have yourself a good Thanksgiving and come back again soon.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. You too.
It's progressivism with passion. It's the Left of Lansing podcast, where Pat shines a light on Michigan's progressive movement. Contact Pat at leftoflansing@gmail.com.
It was awesome having Anna Clark back on the podcast this week. She's a remarkable writer, and I will provide links to her ProPublica articles as well as links to her book on the Flint water crisis, and that will be available on leftoflansing.com. And again, Republicans claim to be all about freedom, but remember, they negated our voices back in 2012 when we voted to erase this emergency manager law, which is why we need Democrats to either put up a bill on the floor getting rid of the law or at the very least change it so future EMs must answer to the people they serve. Time now for a Left of Lansing last call.
You could say even this harder than getting a ticket to the Renaissance tour or Rip Britney's tour. She's down in, it's kind of warm in Brazil right now.
Okay, well, that was President Joe Biden mixing up the names of pop stars Taylor Swift and Britney Spears. Now, is Biden the first president to ever get a celebrity's name wrong? No, he's not. I remember when Senator Ted Kennedy called Chicago Cubs slugger Sammy Sosa Sammy Souser back when Sammy and Mark McGwire were battling for the home run record back in 1998. I also remember when President Bill Clinton called Detroit Red Wings icon and Detroit sports icon Steve Yzerman Steve Yzerman, when the 97 Stanley Cup champion Wings visited the White House. I mean, still, I couldn't believe it. I was like, Bill, really? Nobody told you how to pronounce Steve Yzerman's name? Ugh. You know, and that's one thing I have to always give President Obama credit, is that he always knew the names of celebrities. He just did. He kept up to date on that kind of stuff. So Biden's not the first, okay? However, getting Britney and Taylor mixed up might just drive home the narrative for younger voters that Uncle Joe is simply too old. Now, I follow someone who goes by the name of Umish Voter on Twitter, and in their bio, they describe themselves as a med student at U of M who's really into politics, college football, and Taylor Swift. Umish Voter posted that flub by Biden and then tweeted the following, saying, "This is bad. Young people widely circulate this stuff on TikTok." And in another corresponding tweet, they said, "It's the continued galvanizing vibe among 18 to 34-year-olds that he's weak, old, and should retire, and the viral videos every week add fuel. It won't change how liberals like me with good values vote, but there are many who are not." Okay, well, you know, I'll take that. And, you know, the responses from people in that tweet were rather critical of both Umish Voter and of younger voters in general. A lot of people complain that if younger voters won't go to the polls because of that mistake, then young voters deserve what they get with a fascist back in the White House. And, you know, while I'm a middle-aged person who isn't really a Swiftie, don't get me wrong, I think Taylor Swift is a talented songwriter. She's a smart and intuitive businesswoman. She's a remarkable show person, no doubt about that. And not only that, I like how she highlights lots of indie artists, and it's obvious that many of her fellow artists respect Taylor Swift because how many people work with her, right? She just, for some reason, though, doesn't reach me like a Billie Eilish does or Lana Del Rey does. Now, that's just my personal preference, okay? But while I'm a middle-aged person, I believe young people have shown how to move the political needle. Like I said in my opening monologue, the youth vote was key in not only helping re-elect Governor Whitmer and putting Democrats back into control of the state legislature, but they came out in force to enshrine abortion care in our state's constitution and to help make voting easier for them. They also helped push Democrats to do something when it came to gun safety measures after the MSU shooting. They played a huge role in that. Now, it's no secret that President Biden's numbers with younger voters is slipping, due in part of how they disapprove of Biden's embrace of the extreme right-wing Israeli government's bombardment of Gaza and the West Bank. And, you know, middle-aged liberals can get mad and can get all disdainful as they want, but these young people want change fast. They're not as cynical as the baby boomers or the Gen Xers are, okay? And if President Biden's poll numbers keep slipping like they are in Michigan, as a recent Epic MRA poll showed him losing to Trump, perhaps it's time for Democrats and Joe Biden to consider changing something up, maybe even having to drop out. I've talked about that before. However, I will say this for younger voters. If Biden stays, I also suspect that many of these younger voters will still vote for democracy over fascism, and they really won't care about Biden messing up Taylor and Britney's names. I just refuse to think that there are a lot of young people out there who vote for that reason. I mean, come on. He's not the only 80-year-old person who doesn't really know that much about Taylor Swift and Britney Spears. Besides, like me, Britney's over 40 years old, so to the young people there, we're just as old as Joe, right?
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan, it's Pat Johnston.
That's going to do it for this edition of The Left of Lansing. Thanks again to Anna Clark for being my guest this week. Next week, Democratic State Representative Emily Diefendorf will be on the podcast. Diefendorf represents the 77th District, which includes East Lansing and DeWitt. We'll talk about the representative's push for a homeless bill of rights, streamlining the name-changing process, and of course, the recent clean energy, abortion rights, and gun safety bills just signed into law, and what Democrats can do in the House since it'll be an even split with Republicans for a while. All that and more is coming up next week. Until then, have a safe and great Thanksgiving holiday. Go Lions! You know, if the Lions beat the Packers on Thanksgiving, the Lions will have clinched their second straight winning season. But we want more than just winning seasons, right? Boy, I can't believe I'm so optimistic about the Detroit Lions. What's going on? Remember, like the Lions, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan!
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston. Written by Pat Johnston. Researched by Pat Johnston. Edited by Pat Johnston. And hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.